Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Mel Brooks. And Mike, I know you have some great Mel Brooks stories, so let's start there.
All right. Thank you for the invitation to do so. I actually met Mel Brooks once. He was with his friend and collaborator, Carl Reiner. And the thing is, they were on a book tour for a book called The 2000-Year-Old Man in the Year 2000. And this is a good place to give a sense of how Mel Brooks became a national celebrity. We'll backtrack and talk about the earlier life, but it was really in the 1960s that he first became known to a really wide public, specifically because Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner recorded a series of albums. Remember albums? They recorded a series of albums between 1961 and 1974. These were best-selling record albums. Millions of people bought these things. And so what was it all about? A very basic, really simple conceit, namely that they envisioned a character known as the 2000-year-old man. And you know, when you live that long, you in effect have known everybody. So the 2000-year-old man, you know, he knew Jesus Christ. He dated Joan of Arc. I mean, all the way through history, you see these things playing out. And so the public really, really took to them. And this, so then within a few years of starting the record albums, not surprising that they would both segue into film. So when I met Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, they were sitting next to each other and I had a chance to talk with them for a bit. And they were trading what I call mock insults. A reminder that they really are vaudevillians. They're like these borscht belt comedians. Like, you know, I throw an insult at you and you say, oh yeah, well you, and you know, you go back and forth. And everything short of actually pummeling each other, right? And it's like verbal pummeling, you know, hitting each other verbally that way. Some of it's goofy as in stupid, but stupid funny. And that's a lot of Mel Brooks, isn't it? Stupid funny. So when I met them, it would have been 1997, and they were both in great shape. By that I mean, you know, really still vigorous and just really a lot of fun to be with. I'll give two very brief quotes from the book that we were there for to give a sense of what that kind of humor can be like. In the book, there's a line where the 2000-year-old man character says, I knew Jesus before they named a religion after him. And so much of Mel Brooks' comedy later, like History of the World Part One, other things, he plays off of a lot of historical episodes. And we'll talk about this as we go along here. You know, episodes from film history, film genre, right? He really knows that stuff. But also just through history, he loves to delve back there. And the second one I'll quote briefly is, when you're a 2000-year-old man, you've been married many, many times and you have a lot of children. So the line here is, I have more than 42,000 children and not one comes to visit me. Now, think about that in terms of what I call Jewish humor. And we should talk about this as we go along here. There's a kind of, you know, Yiddish quality to this. There's a sense really of the Jewish theatrical tradition in terms of the kind, and we'll talk more about the borscht belt there, but when you hear lines like that, you realize this is culturally specific. This is coming out of Brooklyn, New York, in his case. This is coming out of the early to mid 20th century. The kinds of comedians, the kind of vaudeville theater tradition that they're coming out of, with specifically Jewish content. I mean, we'll talk about this in some of the later movies. There are a lot of Jewish jokes in his films. I mean, overtly Jewish jokes, right? Both visual and verbal. But a lot of the underlying ethos, if you will, is essentially of a borscht belt comedian working the Catskills. You know, he always kept that quality. So I'll turn it back to you. And then I think we'll probably, segue a bit into talking about the early life.
Okay. It's interesting you mentioned the Jewish humor, because I saw a clip with former President Barack Obama. I think it was a celebrity roast. And introducing Mel Brooks, he said, every 10 Jews, God makes a crazy one to make everyone laugh, which, great line, also sounds like something Mel Brooks would have written, because his jokes are very Catskills, kind of, you know, take my wife, please, kind of thing, coming from his original days with Sid Caesar and the Show of Shows.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned take my wife, please. That's an old Henny Youngman. It was old even when Henny Youngman said it, right? And Henny Youngman actually has a cameo in History of the World Part One. Like, he likes to actually use some of the talent that he grew up with that way. But let's actually go back to those origins. He's from Brooklyn, New York. So much great talent came from there. He's born in 1926. So, you know, he is growing up in the very late 20s, really growing up in the Depression years, in the World War II years. And professionally, he becomes a drummer in the Catskills and then segues from that into specifically becoming a comedian at Grossinger's, one of the most famous of the Jewish resorts in the Catskills, what was known as the Borscht Belt. And there's a lot of Yiddish that actually gets worked into the comedy routines. I mean, a lot, you know, I learned a lot of Yiddish actually from following comedians like this. Now, in terms of the name, his actual birth name was Melvin Kaminsky. Why would he have changed that? A lot of performers of his generation would have anglicized their names or had their names anglicized by an agent, let's say, or a producer, a studio, right? That's a whole separate discussion in a way. We could go on for a half hour just about that. But that wasn't the case here with Mel Brooks. It wasn't like he was trying to hide or somehow change that Jewish identity. He had a very particular reason for changing his name. Namely that when he was coming along in the Catskills, there was a very well-known trumpet player named Max Kaminsky. And Melvin Kaminsky was worried that he'd be confused with Max Kaminsky. And so he decided to change his name for that reason. What he did was Mel Brooks took his mother's maiden name, which was Brooks, and made it his own. So it was not an issue of, you know, a Jewish comedian looking to somehow anglicize his name, i.e. his identity. And it wasn't that at all, really. It was a very pragmatic move to give himself, a name that could be his own in that respect. Now, when you mention, you know, Sid Caesar, from 1949 through the 1950s, Mel Brooks was a member of that celebrated group of comedy writers who sat around a conference table, kibitzing. Yeah, we get to use Yiddish already. Kibitzing around the conference table, writing gags for Sid Caesar. And it's an amazing lineup there. You have Mel Brooks, you have the future playwright Neil Simon and his brother Danny. You have Woody Allen, in a way like Woody Allen before he's Woody Allen, you know, Neil Simon.
I think Woody Allen was the typist at the time. Woody Allen like we know today.
No, I mean, they're all sitting around the table and they're throwing stuff around and it's a ruthless group. And that's great for creativity. Like you come up with a one-liner and the guy on the other side of the table says, that's terrible. That's the worst joke I've ever heard in my life. You know, and you insult each other, you go back and forth. Sid Caesar, famously, I interviewed Sid Caesar once and I can attest to his volatile personality. He comes bursting into the room and says, what'd you guys come up with today? Oh, that's awful. You know, and so you argue and you shout and then, you threaten to throw somebody out the window and it gets all worked up that way. But Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows was an incredible cultural phenomenon in the 1950s. He was so famous. I mean, to the level like Milton Berle kind of famous, and people knew him there. The writers at that point, they're behind the scenes, right? I mean, they're pretty much writing for Sid Caesar, and it's important to remember that. That's why, even though creatively he's sharpening his skills in the 1950s, it's gonna be what I mentioned earlier, that record album collaboration with Carl Reiner, the 2,000-year-old man, that's gonna put him before the public in a more direct way. So he's been before the public. He's been a nightclub comedian, Borscht Belt veteran and all that. And you know, the names are certainly known within the industry. These are the guys who write for Sid Caesar. And then it's really towards the end of that decade that they start to break out on their own for individual careers.
In terms of exposure to Mel Brooks, I mean, the things that I saw that I enjoyed them before I ever heard of anybody named Mel Brooks, starting with Get Smart, the TV show, which I absolutely love and think it's a high watermark of all TV. I even think that the remake movie was actually pretty good. I remember watching that on TV. I actually saw Blazing Saddles at the drive-in in Laurel when I was in high school. And my husband and I went on a date to see Spaceballs when it came out. And although we didn't think the movie was as funny as the guy in front of us, who laughed hysterically at every single joke. And we laughed because he was so funny. So every time I watch Spaceballs, I remember more the experience of watching it with that one guy with the really, you know, guffawing through the whole thing.
Yeah, when we talk about Mel Brooks in this phase of his career, again, go back to the 1950s. He's working as a writer primarily for Sid Caesar. Getting into the 60s, yeah, he and Carl Reiner are public personalities with the album. He's becoming better known, but he still has a tendency at that point to be a writer and eventually like writer slash producer and so on. In other words, a lot of that is behind the camera, behind the scenes, if you will, where the public wouldn't, like with Get Smart, you know, we think about Don Adams, right? We think about the agent there, and enough people would have known that Mel Brooks and Buck Henry actually created Get Smart. But, you know, for the general public, they're watching Don Adams on screen. So that's the point I'm making there. If you look at the 50s into the 60s, there is some, camera recognition for Mel Brooks himself, but honestly, a lot of that work is where he's on the other side of the camera. And he'll continue that even later in his career. When he's starring in his own movies, he's also writing or co-writing them, he's producing them. You know, he's always had that versatility, that mobility to work in front of the camera and behind it. But the real breakthrough, let's get to the real breakthrough. This is when he has his directorial debut with The Producers in 1968. And he wins an Academy Award for original screenplay. I should point out he'd already won an Academy Award. This is a little known fact. He had won an Oscar for a cartoon short called The Critic years earlier. So already, yeah, we get into the late 60s, he has two Academy Awards, not bad. The thing about The Producers is it's one of the great all-time bad taste films that one could ever indulge in.
I like that, bad taste films. That's a really funny way of putting it, because I think every one of his movies, no matter how irreverent, has some sort of message behind it that isn't necessarily very obvious. But Mel Brooks himself was a true intellectual. I mean, apparently he, you know, goes to bed at 3 a.m. because he stays up late at night and reads classics. You know, behind all of the jokes is a really, really sharp mind. And they say, show me a man who knows what's funny, and I'll show you a man who knows what isn't. Which is to say, you know, most comedians have, you know, a tough life, or they've experienced things that make them sympathetic, that go beyond jokes.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about The Producers a little bit more, because it really is the breakthrough for him. It really is, as I say, one of the all-time great bad taste comedies. And if people aren't familiar with the storyline, it's really, really kind of primal, if you will. Zira Mostel, and let's pause on that for a moment, in the sense that the acting in a Mel Brooks movie is typically not the kind of acting that wins Academy Awards. It's over the top. It's really silly. It's so extroverted. And Zira Mostel was perfect for that, because you almost felt like the frame itself was too small to contain him. Not just because he was a physically bulky actor, but he had the big gestures of a nightclub comedian, of a Borscht Belt comedian, the arms waving out, you know, the eyes bugging out, everything, you know, oversized and exaggerated. And so Zira Mostel is perfectly cast here as a really corrupt Broadway producer who comes up with a scam. He thinks, well, you know, people are always trying to make money off of new Broadway musicals. What if we are able to get a whole lineup of investors, sweet little old ladies that he's courting, and they'll all put some money into the show, and, you know, and they'll think it's going to be a great big deal, but we're intending it to be a failure. And so what we can do is then we can open and close on the same night, if you will, but we will have gotten all their money, right? And then we can abscond with it. So that's, it's really primal by way of material. So Zira Mostel is that corrupt producer. And of course, Gene Wilder is like the honest, little slow-witted accountant there, and in the interplay between the two of them. And in terms of how Zira Mostel's characters, you know, trying to think of a show that's guaranteed to fail, they think, well, let's make, you know, this really, really glitzy, celebratory story about Adolf Hitler, right? You know, and present him as the protagonist and so on. And then, of course, The Producers has got one of the all-time great bad taste production numbers, Springtime for Hitler. And as often as I see it, I think, oh my goodness, you can't get, you know, in terms of poor taste, not being politically correct, you can't get much worse than this. And that's why it's so delightful, because it goes against all the rules and regulations of appropriate behavior, of good taste and all those nice things. And so, you know, what was astounding about The Producers was that he was able to make this film and really, you know, it was a box office success, and it really kind of put him on the map. And it was his first film as a director. And as I said earlier, he won the Academy Award for Original Screenplay. And a kind of belated 1-2 punch, just as The Producers really made his career in 1968 as a film director and as a real presence in Hollywood, he got a really, really big late career boost in 2001 when he created and oversaw the Broadway musical version of The Producers. Bear in mind that for that musical theater production, that was a huge Broadway hit. And Mel Brooks co-wrote the book and wrote the music and lyrics. And we can talk about this. Throughout his career, he's actually composed quite a bit of music and the lyrics as well. We'll mention that in some of the other films there. And then as a kind of addendum to that big Broadway hit of The Producers in the early 2000s, then in 2005, there was a movie version of the Broadway show with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. Not a particularly good movie, but just a sense of within Mel Brooks' overall career, the kind of clout, the kind of influence that The Producers had, both in the late 60s as a film and then as a Broadway musical earlier in this century.
You know, the interesting thing about that is that he made a movie about making a flop play, which then became a hit play about a flop play, and then they made a movie about it.
I almost want to turn it over to the philosophers or something. You know what I mean? It's getting kind of metaphysical. I know what you're saying, but this is a kind of wild side observation. But when you think about like John Waters' Hairspray, you think of how, you know, you have different iterations of the movie and then to the stage, and it becomes a creative property. And Mel Brooks had that ability. But Marie, what I wanted to do is also follow up on your really, really smart observation before about Mel Brooks typically being taken as the silly, goofy, you know, lowbrow comedian and so on. But he actually is a very intelligent man, reads a lot. Earlier, as we were talking, and I mentioned his interest in history. Yeah, it's kind of goofball, but he knows about, you know, Jesus Christ. And, you know, as a Jewish man, he knows a lot about Jesus Christ. He knows about the Inquisition. He knows about the Crusades. He knows about American history. He knows about the history of Hollywood genres, the Western for Blazing Saddles, on and on. We'll talk about that. But how smart he is there. And that more serious side of him, the fact that in 1980, he set up his own production company, Brooks Films. And what did he do? He produced a movie version of the Broadway hit, The Elephant Man, which is not a funny story at all. It's a completely serious story. And moreover, he hired David Lynch to direct it, to make his first feature film. And I actually interviewed David Lynch in 1980, and I asked him about that. And he said, nobody was more surprised than he was that he got a phone call from Mel Brooks, of all people, asking him if he wanted to direct The Elephant Man. It's a really good, highly regarded film, which is highly recommended. But why do I mention that? Well, it really shows that more serious side of Mel Brooks. Even in the silly comedies, he knows what he's sending up, doesn't he? He knows the subject matter really well, whether it's Hollywood genres or, you know, American and world history, any number of things he's making fun of. That comedy works because he knows the subject matter so well. So particularly in his later career, he's done some more serious things. For instance, the year after The Elephant Man, or a few years after that, he made a film called 84 Charing Cross Road, you know, as a producer. But those are things you would not associate with Mel Brooks, the slapstick comedian, would you?
No, no. When I think of Mel Brooks, I think of outrageousness, you know, poor taste, funny jokes, gags, vaudeville. And it's amazing how well his shtick endures. I had never actually seen the movie The Producers until this past week. Of course, I had heard about it. But I remember hearing a lot about it from my daughter, who found out about it in school and came home singing Springtime for Hitler and thought it was just, this is hysterical. And I knew it had to be Mel Brooks, because only Mel Brooks can get away with it. But Mike, how does he manage to get away with it?
Well, he gets away with it because he's shameless in that respect. No, I'm really serious about that, that approach to comedy. In other words, if you know that a joke is in poor taste, and that's why you're telling it, and you know people will like really give you a look or even take you to task, he's never been politically correct. And you know, that's not an expression that would have been used back in the day when he made a lot of this stuff. But it was essentially going against all the conventions of good taste. So in terms of like satirically treating any number of situations, he doesn't have a censor mechanism there. And he knows some of the jokes are really bad, and that doesn't hinder him either.
No.
This is something I find fascinating. His films, even his best films, oftentimes are kind of scattershot. And I attribute this really going all the way back to Sid Caesar's Your Show shows. They were writing sketch comedy. And in sketch comedy, you do something because it's funny, you know, and the sketch itself lasts 10 minutes. Think about, and we'll talk about individual films at this point, but think about any number of Mel Brooks films where they're kind of loosely connected. They're episodic. They really have like a funny sketch and then some, like a non sequitur or something that has almost nothing to do with that. And then it bounces back and forth. They're very loosely constructed. Not all of them, but most of them tend to be loosely constructed. And they're uneven. You know, you have a really great sequence and then another one's kind of so-so, but they won't stop. You know what I'm getting at? It's like that Borscht Belt comedian who won't stop telling jokes. And if you groan at one joke, he says, oh yeah, you didn't like that one. Well, try this one. You know what I'm getting at? It's like a cannon firing and firing and firing. He doesn't let up. The comedy's always hitting you that way. Some jokes hit, some miss. It's like you reach into the joke bag and you pull out the next joke. And so again, when we talk about bad taste, a lot of it's just not being hindered by any convention of good taste or appropriate subject matter or, you know, what's considered correct behavior. No. You just launch into it. And a lot of comedians, you know, essentially are anarchists, aren't they? I mean, not just Mel Brooks, but a lot of comedy, you know, think about the Marx Brothers, right? You're going against, you're upending convention. You want to be in poor taste in a way because you know that'll get a laugh.
Actually, one of the quotes I attribute to people talking about Mel Brooks is, if you're going to go up to the bell, ring it. And he does. I mean, he is shameless in that way. There's also a quote from Joan Rivers about him saying, if you make people laugh at something, you've won. And that may be part of why he's able to do things like in the trailer for Young Frankenstein, my all-time favorite Mel Brooks film. He's, you know, doing the voiceover for the trailer. At the end, he says, you know, Young Frankenstein in black and white, no offense. And since all of his movies are supposed to have some sort of message behind it, what would you say it was for the producers, Mike? And do you have an idea of what his other movies' themes or underlying message would have been?
I don't think it really reduces to that kind of message or moral film by film. I think he's just simply indulging in that kind of absolute silliness and rebellion against convention and so on. I mean, I don't really see it in a synthesizing way. You know, what does the film mean? Or he's having fun. He's sending up genres. He's really upending all those conventions. So I think it's more a matter just simply of, you know, if you go to see a Borscht Belt comedian, you're going to see funny material, and it's not, you know, being particularly shaped in terms of a narrative. And so a lot of his films, I think, register more on that level of, you know, let's take a genre and make fun of it. And you make fun of it because you love it. You know it well historically, and you want to have some fun with it. Let's actually turn on that and segue to what I would consider his golden phase or golden age. You know, we talked about in the 1950s as a writer with Sid Caesar, and then the record albums with Carl Reiner, and, you know, on stage a lot himself, but then really becoming a major Hollywood filmmaker. The golden age, as I would call it, begins with The Producers in 1968, and then it's really more in the mid-1970s that he scores and scores and scores with a series of real big box office hits, critical favorites too. So Marie, let me hand it off to you here, but just with a reminder that this golden age, my gosh, how much he did in just a few years. Blazing Saddles, 1974. Young Frankenstein, the same year. That's amazing. Those are two of his greatest films in the same year. Silent Movie in 1976. High Anxiety, which I know you want to talk about, in 1977.
Well, to talk about Young Frankenstein a little bit, that's a movie that it works every year at Halloween. People who've never seen it think it's funny. It's another, you know, pairing between Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder, which, you know, they worked together on Blazing Saddles and, of course, on The Producers. And I think this is the high watermark for the two of them working together. The movie's hilarious. Gene Wilder plays a descendant of the original Dr. Frankenstein, who is then sort of pulled into, you know, retracing his roots. And one of the things that Mel Brooks has said is that, you know, he keeps returning to this idea of father-son stories. And if you look at his movies, he likes to use that theme. And you can certainly see that in Blazing Saddles and some of his other stuff. He also said that Young Frankenstein is about man making a man, you know, meaning a child, because men can't have children themselves, that this was a way to play with that idea. And he, of course, with the Frankenstein myth, he also wanted to salute and respect the original movie, but, you know, do it with some comedy to hilarious effect.
Well, yeah, you know, as you were making those comments, it had me thinking them through and doubling back on your earlier question, which is not one I honestly had really asked myself to any extent. You know, what is the meaning or message, the moral, as I call it, of these films? And it's a really good question. And you know, my initial response was, I don't think he thinks that way necessarily. You know what I mean? That he's not being reductive quite that way. What am I going to say in this film? But now that I think it through some more, and I'm thinking out loud here, so it's hazardous, I'll fall off the cliff. But as I think out loud here, I think, well, we talked earlier about how smart he is, how well he knows history and literature, and specifically here, like film history. So let's give examples of that, or I'll give some quick examples of that. So part of the message, if you will, is just simply that he wants us to think about all of that film history and so on, and the satirical treatment of older Hollywood genres that is a kind of knowing send-up of them. It's not just totally scattershot. Blazing Saddles, I mean, he really knows a lot about the Western as a genre and can have a lot of fun with it. And again, that lowbrow humor, I mean, one of the all-time greatest sequences in any Mel Brooks film would be what's politely called the campfire scene in Blazing Saddles. And, you know, on the radio, I have to be careful how I describe this, but if you sit around a campfire eating beans, and I'll let it go at that, but, you know, you can't go too low with humor like that, right? And it brings out the inner 10-year-old in all of us, right? We giggle. We know we shouldn't, you know, it's like bathroom humor stuff, but we do. And his films, again, when I said there's no censor mechanism, he goes for that. And likewise in Blazing Saddles, in terms of things like race relations and, you know, any number of serious issues, he treats them in such a way that they're really, really, you know, sent up and satirized. But to one of your good observations before, the fact that, well, that, you know, when you're a comedian, that's what you do, right? You're making fun of things, but you probably do have some more serious progressive points that you're making there. It's not a soapbox speech. It's not being progressive that way, but you're doing it in such a way that you get people to laugh at these things. And if they can laugh at them, you know what I mean? Then you can kind of advance and move on that way. So in terms of, you know, knowing his subject matter, Young Frankenstein, when you watch that film, it's actually very close to the original Frankenstein from 1931 in so many ways. And so the scholarly side, you know, that a real movie buff would have would be, oh, that scene is almost exactly like the one in the Boris Karloff version, you know, and it's, you know, Peter Boyle instead, but fun with things like that. A silent movie, revisiting silent film history. High Anxiety, my gosh, he knows so much about Alfred Hitchcock. There are sequences in High Anxiety that could have been shot by Hitchcock. And the film looks and sounds like a Hitchcock film.
Well, that's a great segue into High Anxiety, but I do want to mention that, because we've talked in other episodes of this show about the persona that an actor will have. So for Blazing Saddles, they actually did approach John Wayne and say, you know, how would you like to be in this movie? And he said, no, there's no way I could be in this movie. You know, my agent wouldn't let it, you know, my contracts wouldn't let it, because he had a particular persona, which would not have worked with Blazing Saddles. He said, but I will be the first person in line to buy a ticket. So that tells you something about how Mel Brooks was really good at, you know, not spoofing something to the point where you're mocking it, although he is in a way, but you can tell there's some appreciation there for, you know, what those Westerns were all about. And for High Anxiety, the one thing to watch for, if you watch this movie, is the whole scene with, it's supposed to be the takeoff on Psycho, and it involves a bellhop being asked by, Mel Brooks himself, you know, can you go get that, go downstairs and get me a newspaper? And the bellhop is played by Baltimore director Barry Levinson. And he, you know, can't find the newspaper first, but, you know, Mel Brooks insists. So Mel Brooks gets into the shower, and it is the classic scene from Psycho, you know, the shot of the shower head, you know, the close-ups of Mel Brooks, who, you know, nobody wants to see Mel Brooks's armpit, you know, when Janet Leigh's in the shower. Maybe you are looking to see, what can I see? I mean, she's a beautiful woman and, you know, she's nude. But with Mel Brooks, it's like, oh my God, no, don't show me that. What is that, Life Boy soap? All of these, you know, details that they're zeroing in on. It's very, very funny. And then in the end, you know, he pulls down the shower curtain after Barry Levinson arrives with the newspaper and starts to beat him with it like it's the knife from Psycho. And the best part of the scene is when the newspaper itself is now on the floor of the tub and the newsprint is going into the drain like the blood from Psycho, which Hitchcock watched it with him, said that was brilliant. He said, but you had 13 shower rings. We only had 10. Now that's an eye for film.
I actually interviewed Barry Levinson the year after High Anxiety came out. He had scripted Injustice for All, the Norman Jewison film in Baltimore. And we talked about High Anxiety, working with Mel Brooks. This was the time when Barry Levinson primarily was a screenwriter. And he talked about how much he learned from Mel Brooks about timing, about how to handle material. And the Levinson role, which is a small but very funny one in High Anxiety, is really letter perfect. I mean, and again, it's very broadly played, but this is, you know, extroverted acting. It's not nuanced Academy Award style acting. And High Anxiety, and Marie, you know this so well, how perfectly he captures qualities in Hitchcock films, specifically Psycho, but even more so, I'd say North by Northwest, Vertigo, you know, not just the material, but almost like shot by shot. He's thinking like Hitchcock, thinking, how are you gonna shoot this sequence? There are, again, as I said before, the use of the cinematography and the musical score, or any number of things which could come directly out of a Hitchcock film. So he's sending it up, but it's in a loving way. That's the best satire, right? He's making fun of something that he really loves.
Now, my two picks for, you know, Mel Brooks, if you've never seen anything, would be Young Frankenstein and High Anxiety. What's your pick, Mike?
Those are great choices. I also would mention certainly Blazing Saddles and The Producers. You know, this is the handful of really great comedies that he made. A lot of his later films are kind of uneven. And, you know, even though I kept working a lot in the 80s and 90s, creatively, I think they taper off a bit. Do you want to talk about particular films there in that respect?
In that respect, I would just say that the best part of Dracula, Dead and Loving It, is the title, which is so Mel Brooks. The movie itself is very uneven, but the title is genius.
That uneven quality is something I wanted to focus on for a bit. I just recently rewatched History of the World Part One, 1981. It sort of plays off of the 2,000-year-old man as you go through history, all the historical figures you can bring to life. He really knows the material and sends it up. Some scenes are funny, some are just stupid, but in terms of the hit or miss quality of it, typical for a Mel Brooks film, there's an enormous cast of a lot of famous people, including some from his own younger phase, Sid Caesar and Henny Youngman and Howard Morris, people he worked with back in the 50s, but then his regular acting troupe. And we've mentioned these people in a piecemeal way, but people like Harvey Korman and Dom DeLuise and Cloris Leachman, these are actors that Mel Brooks worked with in many of his films, like an acting troupe, isn't it? I mean, they're reliable presences in some of his greatest films. But, you know, as you watch a film like History of the World Part One, it's so hit or miss, and it's so sketch-oriented. Again, reiterating what we said about that kind of sketch comedy. Yeah, one gag works, another falls flat. It just keeps pushing along there. But when it works, it really works. It hits big time. My favorite episode in that particular film is when Mel Brooks playing Moses, talk about typecasting, Mel Brooks playing Moses, comes down the mountain. He's actually holding three tablets. He announces, I want to share with you, you know, these 15 commandments. And then he drops one of them and it shatters. And he says, these 10 commandments.
Yes, he really was great with the gags, but also the sight gags. My favorite moment in Young Frankenstein, and we quote this extensively in my family, is when Gene Wilder is, you know, he's arrived at Frankenstein's castle and he's trying to find his grandfather's notes, you know, wanting to know how he managed to do what he did. And he comes across a book called How I Did It. And, you know, it's just a great sight gag, which I don't think ever gets old. But that, unfortunately, brings us to the end of our segment. So don't forget to check out those Mel Brooks movies. And also, look for our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.